The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individuals participating in the podcast. This podcast also contains subject matter which may not be suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised.
My guest tonight is Jon Stewart.
I know we're all vaccinated, and I'm not going to get COVID, but I'm going to get something. I'm honestly, these people did not take good care of themselves during the pandemic.
Making this series, I've thought about this Jon Stewart moment a lot. He said something out loud that most people on TV weren't going anywhere near at the time, pointing out something that seemed obvious to him.
How do you feel about the science now,
well,
though?
So I will say this, and I honestly mean this. I think we owe a great debt of gratitude to science. Science has, in many ways, helped ease the suffering of this pandemic, which was more than likely caused by science.
What do you mean by that? Do you mean like there's a chance that this was created in a lab, there's an investigation?
A chance?
Well, there's evidence, I'd love to hear it.
There's
I don't know.
A novel respiratory coronavirus overtaking Wuhan, China. What do we do? Oh, you know who we could ask? The Wuhan novel respiratory coronavirus lab. The disease is the same name as the lab. That's just a little too weird, don't you think?
But it could be possible, you could be right, it could be possible that they have the lab in Wuhan to study the novel coronavirus diseases because in Wuhan, there are a lot of novel coronavirus diseases because of the bat population there.
I understand.
It's like the same.
It's
like,
a
wait
local
a second.
Specialty, and it's the only place to find bats. You won't find bats.
Nobody's like
else.
Saying
oh,
why.
Wait, Austin, Texas has thousands of them that fly out of a cave every night. Every night at dusk. Is there a coronavirus, an Austin coronavirus? No, it doesn't seem to be an Austin coronavirus. The only coronavirus we have is in Wuhan.
Yes.
Where they have a lab called, what's the lab called again, Stephen?
The Wuhan Novel Coronavirus Lab.
I believe that's the case.
And now, how long have you worked for Senator Ron Johnson?
Let me tell you something. Let me tell you something about Ron Johnson. So a few years back.
You know, we stopped filming a long time ago.
I understand that. Can I tell you something? This is what happens. I've been alone for so long. And when I realized that the laboratory was having the same name, first name and last name, of the evil that had been plaguing us, I thought to myself, that's up. Listen to what I'm saying.
Now, Jon Stewart is not an expert. He's not someone I'd look to for scientific answers. But the way he framed the question made a lot of viewers pause for a second and think, okay, why aren't we at least allowed to wonder about this? I get it. We trust experts. They make us feel safe. They give us that sense of stability when everything feels chaotic. But does feeling reassured always mean we're getting the full picture? I don't know. Not after spending time with the material I've been reviewing, and not after the things I'm about to get into. Tenderfoot TV, I'm Payne Lindsay, and this is Leaked, Episode 3, Strange Loops.
So, on January 27th, there's another twist. Dr. Fauci is contacted over email by this scientist named Christian Anderson.
Christian Anderson is a virologist based in California who sort of started out as this whistleblower that the virus seemed unusual and might have resulted from a lab accident.
I'm watching Jennifer's documentary the same way I go through raw interviews in a case. Stop, rewind, take notes, replay, let something sit for a minute.
He appears to be writing a lot of emails and they're happening like late at night.
Jenner's been digging into this way longer than I have, so I'm paying attention to the specific things he's flagging. For me, it's always the small things, the quiet details, the ones that tend to tell a bigger story.
And this is where this guy Jeremy Farrar comes in.
So, fair warning here, there are a lot of names, and I'll try to keep it simple. One of the big ones is Jeremy Farrar. He ran the Wellcome Trust, which is a major biomedical research funder in the UK. According to the records Jenner pulled, Jeremy Farrar sent an email to Fauci on January 31st of 2020 that seems to kick off a series of conversations among several top scientists.
Tony, would really like to speak to you this evening.
We'll call shortly.
Thanks, Tony. Can you phone Christian Anderson? He's expecting your call now. The people involved are Christian Anderson, Bob Gary, and Eddie Holmes.
Something that stood out to me in all these late-night emails between some of the most influential people in this space, the director of the CDC at the time, Dr. Robert Redfield, doesn't seem to be included.
You can look at the emails. Like, not a single email is written to Bob Redfield that night about any of this.
Now, that alone doesn't apply anything, but it does show you who in this group was considered essential in that moment and who wasn't a part of those initial conversations. Then there's an email from Fauci.
I told Anderson that as soon as possible, he and Eddie Holmes should get a group of evolutionary biologists together to examine carefully the data to determine if his concerns are validated. He should do this very quickly, and if everyone agrees with this concern, they should report it to the appropriate authorities. I would imagine that in the USA, this would be the FBI, and in the UK, it would be MI5.
There are a lot of ways to interpret tone and writing. Trust me, I've reread my own emails, and sometimes I'm like, what am I saying? But to me, it doesn't read like he thought the concerns were ridiculous. It reads like someone saying, okay, let's make sure this gets looked at carefully, and let's keep it contained until we know more. That's not denial, and it's not confirmation of anything either. It's someone trying to manage a situation with a lot of uncertainty around it. A few hours later, Christian Anderson replies.
The unusual features of the virus make up a really small part of the genome, 0.1%. So one has to look really closely at all the sequences to see that some of the features potentially look engineered. I should mention that after some discussions earlier today, Eddie, Bob, Mike, and myself all find the genome inconsistent with expectations from evolutionary theory. But we have to look at this much more closely, so those options could still change.
What he says is basically, there's a couple unusual features here. They're small, and we need to look closely before saying anything definitive. But right now, it doesn't perfectly line up with what we'd expect from natural evolution. That's not a conclusion, it's not a claim, it's just an early observation. One that he also says might change with more information. And that nuance matters.
You have scientists from around the world, some of them actually advise governments, and they have invited Christian Anderson, who had emailed Fauci earlier with his concerns that this may be a lab leak.
The next day, 13 scientists from around the world join a private call. These are the heavy hitters, people who advise governments and run major research programs. What exactly was said on that call? We don't really know. There's very little public documentation of the actual discussion itself.
It seems like they're going to use the Slack as a way to chat during the call.
A few Slack messages exchanged during the call give us a tiny, imperfect window into the tone.
The call appears to have been a shouting match between Anderson and Holmes, who had these suspicions about unusual aspects of the genome. And we also know through Slacks that were exchanged during the call that there was some sort of quote-unquote big ask. But we don't know what the big ask was.
And you look at these Slacks, whatever these dudes were asked to do, Anderson thinks it's hard to pull off.
It sounds like there was a disagreement, tension, and something referred to as, quote, a big ask. We don't know what that means, and I'm not going to pretend we do, but I've covered enough sensitive stories to know that high-pressure moments often involve a push for unity, or caution, or simply keeping things orderly until more information comes in. That's not sinister. That's human nature in uncertain situations.
As scientists work to contain the coronavirus, researchers are still trying to figure out where it came from. Early research suggests human picked up the coronavirus from animals, possibly bats, but it's not clear how the virus made that jump.
3 days later, four of the scientists on that call publish Proximal Origin, the paper that becomes a central piece of the natural origin argument. It's cited everywhere. It becomes the go-to reference for months. And that raises a fair question, not about motive, but about process. How did the scientific community reach such a confident public stance so quickly, when behind the scenes, there seemed to be a lot of uncertainty? That's what I'm interested in trying to understand.
A disease that can spread from animals to humans is called zoonosis. Coronavirus is a zoonotic disease.
Obviously, if you look at the history of these viruses, we have SARS, which we know it went from a bat to a civet cat to a human. MERS went from a bat to a camel to a human. If you look at the sequencing, you can make an assumption that a bat was involved one way or another. So that's the likely issue.
There's been several outbreaks, and almost in every single case, there have been some questions about a suspicious origin for it.
To get more context, I started digging into interviews with Charles Rixey. He's a former Marine and chief of CBRN, the unit trained to assess chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear threats. Meaning, when something unusual happens biologically, his job was to figure out if this was natural, accidental, or deliberate.
My job was to gather intelligence from different sources related to weapons of mass destruction, and anytime we were deployed in our area of operations, and if there was the potential of chemical or biological weapons being used, to advise the commander on what to do.
Listening to him doesn't give me any answers, but it does give me perspective. Perspective on how past outbreaks were investigated, and just how complicated origins can be.
Throughout history, biological weapons have been used. Even during the early stages of the Black Plague, when the Turks brought it from Central Asia, they would take plague-ridden bodies and catapult them into the cities in order to help spread the plague so that way they could weaken cities that they were besieging. The next really good example is from 1763, when the British used blankets from smallpox victims and gave them to Native Americans with the intent of getting them sick, and ultimately that killed more than 1,000 Indians just in that one outbreak. A more recent example would be in the late 1930s when Japan invaded northern China. They used bombs loaded with fleas, with anthrax, to spread a variety of pathogens, killing hundreds of thousands of people in that instance. But the best example would be in Old Lyme, Connecticut in the mid-1970s. What we now know is that a place called Plum Island that sits about a dozen miles off the coast of Connecticut, that was testing various pathogens, and one of those pathogens was Lyme disease. Lyme disease used to be called something else. It was incredibly rare, and it mostly occurred in the Rocky Mountain area on the other side of the United States. And so to have an outbreak in Old Lyme, Connecticut, is very bizarre because Lyme disease is spread by ticks. So it could have been that those diseased ticks were able to get out of the facility and hitch a ride on deer that can swim across that body of water, or birds that were flying back and forth. In any respect, it's so understood that I used to teach my Marines as part of our curriculum about the fact that this lab on Plum Island was almost certainly the source of the Lyme disease outbreak, and it was used as a cautionary tale for the fact that labs are known to be a potential source of any pathogen if they're studying it all across the world.
Charles brings up Plum Island and Lyme disease, which mainstream sources reject as a valid explanation. And that's important to say clearly. The scientific consensus does not support that theory. But what I take from his point isn't this happened. It's that inside the biodefense circles, lab accidents are treated as a real risk long before the public ever hears about them. There's often a gap between internal caution and public reassurance. And that gap alone is worth noting.
There have also been outbreaks of Zika virus, the flu, H1N1 pandemic from 2009, and Ebola Zaire virus, which was 2014. The West Africans believe that the origin of Ebola was a lab origin. It was called Ebola Zaire because it emerged in Zaire, which is 2,000 miles away from where the outbreak ultimately sprang up. So to put that into perspective, that would be like saying that there was an Ebola Florida strain that appeared in Denver out of the blue with no connecting outbreaks or anything of any kind.
That lab had a lot of connections to Christian Anderson and Bob Gary.
They were funded by Wellcome Trust, tied to Jeremy Farrar.
Another thing I noticed, looking across different outbreaks, is that some of the same scientists show up in major origin papers again and again. That doesn't automatically mean anything bad. Small scientific communities often have recurring experts. But it did make me wonder about how these narratives get shaped, and by whom. Again, not a conclusion, just something I filed away.
And what's important about that is that four of the five authors of the Proxima Origin also served as authors on the origin paper for the Ebola outbreak. And two of those authors were actually directly involved in research taking place in Sierra Leone in 2013 in a lab that there is a decent chance that the Ebola Zaire strain came from. So the same group of authors, whether it was from discussing HIV origins, or they were talking about the Ebola origins, or the Zika virus origins, or even the H1N1 virus, and then ultimately the COVID-19 origin papers. All of those papers had links with some of the same authors, which once again, in retrospect, after deeply examining the origin of the COVID-19 pandemic, it looks increasingly suspicious.
Before I start leaning in any direction, I try to challenge myself. So I dive into the research on bats, and a lot of it makes sense.
They're the only mammals that can fly.
Bats carry a huge number of viruses. They travel far. They live in dense groups. And they've been the source of outbreaks before.
Bats don't just host deadly diseases. They seem to tolerate them really well.
So pointing to bats as a possible origin isn't unreasonable at all.
They are fast and powerful flyers and can travel 1,000 miles in just a few nights.
But even with that in mind, two things still stuck with me. One, how quickly some viruses seem to adapt to humans. Two, how often the same few people are involved in shaping the early origin narrative.
It's striking that over and over again, we do see the same actors saying the same things, pushing the same narrative across decades.
Today, the World Health Organization warned that the Zika virus is spreading explosively. By the end of the year, it could infect 4 million people.
Zika was another in a long line of outbreaks that occurred, that the potential origins were written by many of the same authors, and two of those authors were actually directly involved in research taking place in Sierra Leone in 2013 in a lab.
Up to this point, everything is interesting, but nothing is definitive. These are loose threads, context, not conclusions. What I'm looking for, and what I think most people want, is something clearer. Something that shows how decisions were made, and why. And in the interviews Jenner shared, again, he's been working with this material for years. There's one topic that really made me stop.
Well, the optimism evaporated yesterday, and the situation darkened dramatically today. The chief health officer for Washington, D.C. was blunt. This is a different day.
I have been actively involved in examining the gaps in current U.S. government oversight of biodefense-oriented research.
Richard Ebright, a professor at Rutgers, studies biosafety and biodefense. He understands how labs are supposed to operate and where oversight gets complicated.
Mishaps include both accidental releases of pathogens, as likely occurred with SARS-CoV-2, leading to the COVID-19 pandemic, and deliberate releases of pathogens, as happened in 2001 in the anthrax mailings.
Listening to him talk about the anthrax case, how the investigation unfolded, how the response shaped funding decisions, gives you a sense of how one event can drastically reshape scientific priorities.
In just a week's time, we have had 4 confirmed cases of anthrax, all with media connections.
Americans are stocking up on emergency equipment in case there is a bioterrorist attack. People all over the country are looking for ways to protect themselves and their families.
It's not about proving a point. It's about understanding how the system reacts to fear.
The anthrax scare took an alarming turn. 2 more appear to have fallen.
9 other individuals in the Washington area are being monitored for the disease.
And 2 more died of suspected anthrax.
After 9/11 and the 2001 anthrax mailings, the immediate response of our government, of all branches of our government, was to expand biodefense research, imagining that the anthrax mailings had come from an external enemy and that we needed to prepare. The person driving those decisions at each step was Dr. Fauci. In 2004, a group of researchers prepared an open letter to the National Institutes of Health director decrying the reprioritization of infectious diseases research funding to biological weapons agents research. And the National Institutes of Health designated Dr. Fauci as the point person to respond to the letter. His argument was that concerns were spurious. There is no concern about increasing risk of deliberate release, about increasing risk of accidental release. This continued through the next decade. In 2005, it's a virus which had then been extinct for decades, the 1918 pandemic influenza virus was reconstructed, brought back in fully infectious form. Members of Congress in both parties asked, why is this research being performed? There was no risk-benefit review, none whatsoever. The funds were provided, the research was performed, the virus was made, a problem now existed. Again, Dr. Fauci was the point person to respond because he is the person who approved the research and the funding. He said the research was essential, urgently needed for public health importance, and that there were guardrails in place to prevent misuse and accidental release. Then, in 2011, 2 laboratories approved by Dr. Fauci had engineered avian influenza H5N1, an influenza that infects birds and almost never infects humans, but when it infects humans, kills 2/3 of them. When that became known, there was an outcry. Dr. Fauci responded by joining with NIH Director Francis Collins to prepare an opinion piece, an op-ed in the Washington Post, declaring that this kind of research is a risk worth taking. He doubled down. He said, this is the right kind of research and we will do more of it. The pause went into effect. And Dr. Fauci and Francis Collins violated the pause. For a whole series of projects, they allowed funding to continue. And this includes the project in Wuhan. Anderson and Gary had a large grant proposal for research on emerging infectious diseases in West Africa. That was on Fauci's desk for approval. And now it is in the phase in which NIH staff decide which proposals will be selected. That review was occurring when Christian Anderson was contacted by Anthony Fauci on January 31st, 2020. That review was occurring throughout drafting, submitting, and publishing the Proximal Origins commentary and ended with Anthony Fauci's signature in May 2020, just after the commentary had been published. So In a real sense, Christian Anderson and Robert Gary had $8.9 million to comply with the preferences of the person whose signature they were literally awaiting at the time. Every person on the February 1st telecon understood implicitly that on one side, you have the funding agency directors and several scientists, and on the other side, you have their grantees arguing for a lab origin. The moment that the funding agency officials said, all three of us are in agreement that discussion of this subject would be a potentially grave threat to science and international harmony, every person in the room knew what was being ordered.
Then there's the emails from early 2020, hundreds of them, between Fauci's office and other officials.
So the science that's funded by governments, funded through taxpayers, well, if they were lying in this case, then they have every reason to have lied in the past. Because in the case of COVID-19, Dr. Fauci's and the other leading Western scientists, their very first reaction to the publication of the genomes in private was to be absolutely petrified that the origin of this virus might be tied to research that they led, funded, and conducted. Of course, if that were discovered to be true, that would be absolutely devastating for their own careers.
Some phrases stand out, like send a private email, back channels, or text isn't safe. For me, that doesn't scream conspiracy. It screams people navigating a high-pressure, high-stakes moment and being overly cautious, or maybe a little careless with how they talked about sensitive topics. It's messy, but not shocking.
And the travesty is that these public health officials chose instead to protect themselves, instead of being honest with the public about the pandemic. And the truth is, millions of people have died, and the victims' families deserve to know why their family members died. Those people deserve justice. They deserve to know the truth about what happened.
I don't have any idea what he's talking about. There is no back channel at NIAID.
If it was discovered that the exact suspicious elements of the SARS-CoV-2 viral genome are the exact things that link to Anthony Fauci's decades of leadership in virology research, it would be the biggest black eye in the history of science.
Jump ahead to 2024. A congressional subcommittee releases a long report suggesting that a research-related accident is plausible.
Likely emerged because of a lab or research-related accident from the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
Wuhan has a history of conducting gain-of-function research at inadequate biosafety levels.
Researchers at the Wuhan lab were sick with a COVID-like virus a few months before COVID was discovered at a wet market.
By nearly all measures of science, if there was evidence of a natural origin, it would have already surfaced.
It didn't dominate headlines. Most people I know didn't hear about that at all. But hearing that from the same government that once dismissed the idea does make you pause. Not because it proves anything, but because it shows how conclusions can evolve as more information becomes available. It reminds me that much of what we lived through was shaped during a time when no one had perfect clarity.
The 6 feet apart social distancing recommendation was arbitrary and not based on science.
Prolonged lockdowns caused immeasurable harm.
There was no conclusive evidence that masks effectively protected Americans from COVID-19.
NIH's procedures for funding and overseeing potentially dangerous research are deficient, unreliable, and pose a serious threat to both public health and national security.
Look, I get it. Most people don't want to talk about COVID anymore. And honestly, I don't either. It was a hard, confusing time, and we'd all prefer it stayed in the rearview. But the truth is, understanding the early days, how decisions were made, how information was shared, how narratives formed, that stuff matters. Because the next outbreak, whatever it ends up being, will not wait for us to be ready.
Could we be on the verge of another pandemic?
New cases of the bird flu are raising alarms among health officials.
First suspected human case of avian influenza in Canada has been detected.
Health officials in California are reporting a possible case in a child who had no known contact with an infected animal.
Here's the scary part. Half of those patients died from the disease.
And according to some experts I've talked to, we might already be closer to that next chapter than we think.
It's not a question of if, it's more of a question of when. We will have a bird flu pandemic.
That's next time on Leaked.
Thanks for listening to Leaked, a podcast inspired by the documentary Thank You, Dr. Fauci. If you want to see the full story, the interviews, the evidence, and more, check out the documentary streaming now on Angel Studios. Visit angel.com. Leaked is a production of Tenderfoot Labs, produced in partnership with Insight Studios, Angel Studios, and Bombadil Productions. Producers on behalf of Insight Studios are Jenna First, Louis Fenton, Scott St. John, and Arnold Rifkin. Executive producers on behalf of Tenderfoot Labs are Donald Albright, Payne Lindsay, and Alex Vespestead. Tenderfoot Labs' lead producer is Tristan Bankston. Editing by Liam Luxon. Associate editors are Miles Clark and Cameron Taggy. Coordinating producers are John Street and Jordan Foxworthy. Artwork by Where Eagles Dare. Music by Danielle First, Kyrie Mateen, and Jay Ragsdale. Mixed by Dayton Cole. For more podcasts like Leaked, search Tenderfoot TV on your favorite podcast app or visit us at tenderfoot.tv. Thanks for listening.